Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers. Additional KCRW programs and podcasts are available at kcrw.com.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
A new political reality in the Middle East. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The stunning victory of the militant group Hamas has set off blame games in both Israel and the Palestinian territories. In Gaza, rowdy demonstrators attacked President Mahmoud Abbas for his Fatah party's stunning defeat. Hamas is now the major issue in Israel's election campaign. On To the Point, will the burdens of government force Hamas to abandon violence and accept Israel's right to exist? Will Israel, Europe, and the United States continue the services and financial aid that keep the Palestinian territories from collapsing? Will the Arab states help an Islamic party that's taken power through democratic elections? First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Mormon Alney, back with To the Point. By winning the Palestinian parliamentary elections, Hamas has sent shockwaves from the Middle East to Western Europe to the United States. On To the Point, a variety of opinions on the challenges posed by a new political reality. First, this news update. When the president is scheduled to make his State of the Union speech on Tuesday, several polls have sampled his current popularity with the American people. His standing, of course, could have a major impact on races for the Congress and Senate this coming November. The Gallup poll for CNN and USA Today shows that 58% think that the president's second term is a failure so far. Dr. Frank Newport is editor-in-chief for the Gallup poll. Always good to have you with us.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
58%. He's going to have a tough audience on Tuesday.
No question about it. On every indicator we have, this is the worst situation he's been in the Januaries that he's had since January 2001. After 9/11, of course, all the indicators went up. For example, his speech in January 2002 was delivered to an audience of Americans who were giving him 70% plus approval ratings and high satisfaction and cohesion, but things have gone downhill since then, and now at this point, he's got a majority of Americans on a variety of measures who give a negative rather than a positive response to questions about the country and his leadership and what have you.
Which measures are hurting him worse?
Well, I mean, they all kind of are tapping into the same pool of discontent, not as low as it's been at some points in recent history, like Jimmy Carter and even his father, but clearly negative at this point. When I look across all of the data, Warren, that we have and try to analyze it, I think that one key is the economy. We hear a lot about wiretapping and about Iraq and this, that, and the other, but basically, when you come down to it and ask Americans what they're worried about and why they don't think things are going well now, a lot of it comes back to concerns about aspects of the economy, not only unemployment, but things like health care costs, things like the high price of gasoline, things like college costs for middle-class, middle-aged parents, and so forth.
The president himself, of course, says that the economy has improved despite those problems, particularly higher prices for gasoline and heating oil and natural gas, and says the November elections are going to be about peace and prosperity. Does your polling suggest that that is what the elections will be about?
Well, the elections won't necessarily be about peace. They will be about the issue of whether or not we have peace. They won't necessarily be about prosperity. They'll be about the issue of whether or not we have prosperity. You can't get around the fact that it's the economy, stupid. That's going to be a key factor. And despite protestations from the administration, and maybe even from Wall Street, which is, you know, up again today, and some economists, the average American tells us in our polling that they think the economy is not good and is getting worse, not better. And there are a lot of concerns that Americans have economically speaking.
Again, we're talking with Frank Newport, who's executive editor of the Gallup poll. Well, how badly is the president doing on health care, and how is it that he directly is held responsible for it?
Well, as you know, like a quarterback on a football team, you get more credit when the team wins and more blame when the team loses than you probably should. And a president, of course, may not have a lot to do with even the economy more generally, not to mention specific aspects of it like health care. But nevertheless, he gets dinged on that. He gets well below 50% approval ratings on handling health care.
Has the Medicare drug bill problem hurt him badly?
I'm not sure it's hurt him, but I don't think it's helped him either. We know from our polling of those 65 and over that a majority say they're not even going to enroll, and many of them don't understand it. And Americans in general think that the program's been has not worked so far. Those are the exact words we used, has not worked in our polling. But I'm not sure that's going to hurt him, because I actually, Warren, a little bit of good news for the administration. In some polling, people say at least they would give members of Congress credit for having voted for it, because at least they're trying. Even if the program's not working, at least they're trying to do something. So maybe he'll get some credit for effort.
Talking to Frank Newport, executive editor of the Gallup poll, this is To the Point from PRI. What about Iraq? You said that that may or may not be all that important an issue. A lot of people obviously think that it is. But what does your polling show?
Well, it's clearly it's an important issue. I just think the economy is as important as is Iraq. People are conflicted. We were fascinated, of course, here at Gallup when Osama bin Laden himself in his audio tape started talking about American polls. You remember that?
Yes.
He said, Mr. President, your polls show Americans want troops to be withdrawn immediately. Not the case. Americans in the long run, of course, want troops withdrawn, but there's no strong sentiment in anybody's assessment of public opinion that troops should come home immediately.
Osama bin Laden reading the wrong poll.
Well, he was reading the right polls, but not interpreting them correctly.
Okay.
Because the public's in sync to some degree with the idea that we want to withdraw more slowly, even if it was a mistake to have gotten involved initially, as a majority of Americans tell us they think it was.
40% of the people you talk to think that Laura Bush should run for the Senate?
That's right, and she gets job approval ratings in the stratosphere, up, you know, around 8 out of 10 Americans approve of the job she's doing, essentially double that of her husband. So, you know, we keep talking, Warren, about Hillary and Condi in 08. Let's hear the drumbeats for Laura.
Really?
No. Somebody asked Bush in a press conference, Bush, the George W., about she running for the Senate, and that's why we put it in a poll, just to find out what the American public could say. I guess she would run from Texas if she ran. That's the state she's from.
Okay. Well, as always, good to talk with you. We'll see if the president can bring up his ratings with the State of the Union speech on Tuesday.
By the way, it's doubtful, based on history, that this one speech Tuesday night is going to have a dramatic effect, but we'll see.
We will indeed. Frank Newport, executive editor of the Gallup poll. Thanks again. In a moment, the new political reality in the Middle East, and on Reporter's Notebook, the last-minute call for a filibuster against Judge Samuel Alito on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
We're only back with To the Point. In Gaza today, angry demonstrators blamed President Mahmoud Abbas for his Fatah party's stunning defeat in Palestinian elections. In the West Bank, Abbas himself asked the winning militant group Hamas to form a new government. Mustafa Barghouti heads the Palestinian National Initiative. That is a democratic opposition group to both Hamas and Fatah. He was elected to the new parliament. Mustafa Barghouti, first of all, congratulations.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
What's going to take place? It appears now that Fatah says that it wants Hamas to form the government, and that Fatah, at the moment at least, does not want to be a party to it. What does that mean?
Well, Fatah has not many choices. Hamas got 79 seats in the parliament out of 132, so it has an absolute majority. No government can be formed without the approval of Hamas. And thus, Mr. Abu Mazen is doing the normal procedure, which is asking the biggest party to form the cabinet. Fatah has lost the power. It's very obvious, and it was punished. It was punished for the failure of the peace process, for the lack of international support for development towards peace, but also it was punished for corruption, mismanagement, and poor performance. I want the audience to know that the fact that Hamas got so many seats does not mean that all these people support Hamas. A lot of independent vote went to Hamas because they wanted to punish Fatah as strongly as possible for their mistakes and poor performance and poor governance. Also, one should not forget the fact that what happened in Palestine was a great performance of democracy. We've never had such decent and transparent elections, and I think we've never had similar democratic process in the whole Arab world before. This is nothing less than a democratic revolution of transformation from one-party rule into a multi-party system. But of course, we are concerned now that we don't want to move from one-party rule into another one-party rule of Hamas.
But if Fatah does not participate in the government, isn't that what we will see?
That is correct. And that's why there are views that there should be a national unity government, in which case Hamas alone would not be able to govern. And there will be a possibility for multi-party contribution or participation in this cabinet. Hamas seems to want that. But one has also to note that the fact that Hamas will run the government does not mean that it will take all the authority in its hand, because the president still will have lots of authorities, and he is an elected president. So it will be a situation where two parties practically will be sharing the power in the same manner that happened in France before, where the president was from one party and the government is from another.
The president, of course, Abu Mazen, as you said, also known as Mahmoud Abbas. Is the reason for a unity government in part in order to assuage the fears and concerns of Israel, the United States, Western Europe, and others who still regard Hamas as a terrorist organization?
Absolutely. This is one factor. But as you know, Fatah is now also very angry about its defeat and does not want also to create a situation where Hamas will take the credit for good work, but Fatah will be asked to do the black work, including handling the very difficult relationship with the Israelis, which has been extremely difficult for the last year, and which were probably partially responsible for this great success of Hamas, since Israel did not help Abu Mazen in any way in achieving a real peace negotiation process or releasing the prisoners or removing the checkpoints. The problem was that in the presidential election in which I participated before and came second, we had a vote for hope. People thought that by voting for Mr. Abbas, they will get a change in the situation, that there will be a true peace process, that checkpoints will be removed, that poverty will be less, that economic aid will come. And so they gave the majority of votes to Mr. Abbas. He was elected. But after 1 year, poverty got worse. The Israeli checkpoints got more. The number of prisoners in Israeli armies grew, in Israeli presence grew from 8,000 to 9,500. And the situation of lawlessness got worse. So people thought that under Fatah, things got worse, and all of everything that Mr. Abbas has promised never happened. The vote on the day of the elections 2 days ago was a vote of anger and depression. And that's why so many voters who are not necessarily convinced that Hamas should govern voted for Hamas. It was a vote of opposition, and a vote of, as I said, that wanted to punish Fatah for its poor performance.
Thank you very much for being with us. Thanks for your insights.
Thank you.
Mustafa Barghouti, the president of the Palestinian National Initiative, an opposition party to both Hamas and Fatah. Once again, he was elected to the parliament in the elections this week. Rami Khoury is editor-at-large of the Daily Star. That's an English-language newspaper based in Beirut. He himself is a Palestinian from Jordan. And Rami Khoury, it's always good to have you on our program.
Nice to be with you again. Thank you.
One of the issues facing Hamas is that it depends on Israel for many services, water, electricity, and other things, depends on Eastern Europe for money and depends on the United States as well. If, in fact, Hamas appears to be isolated because of its stand on terrorism and the refusal to recognize Israel, is it likely to get help from the other Arab countries or the Arab countries?
Well, I think Hamas obviously is in a situation where it has to look at its own positions, but also demand that others review their positions as well. Hamas has more legitimacy now as an elected Arab government or leadership than probably any other government in the entire Arab world. And I say that sticking my neck out possibly a little bit, but I don't think anybody in the Arab world has the legitimacy that Hamas does now through a democratic free election with such a massive majority. There is a disjunction, though. There is a disjointed divergence between Hamas's position on Israel and the position of the majority of Palestinian people on Israel. The majority of Palestinians, we know from polling and other evidence, want to have a fair, negotiated, reasonable, peaceful peace agreement with the Israelis and will coexist with an Israeli state that is predominantly Jewish, as it is now. Hamas doesn't have that position, and they're going to have to figure out how to reconcile those two positions. My guess is that the position on Israel of Hamas will be just left in abeyance for the moment. So the best thing to happen is for Hamas, the Israelis, the Americans, the Europeans, for everybody just to say, here's our position, and it hasn't changed, it's the same as it's always been, and then get on with the business of governance. And Hamas, from local government leadership in places like Qalqilia and other places in the last year, has, in fact, you've had Hamas people dealing with the Israelis directly or indirectly on these practical issues of water and sewage and transport. So they're pragmatic people. These guys are political leaders more than they are firebrand ideologues. They have done many things in their short political life since they came into being to resist the Israelis 20 years ago. They resist the Israeli occupation. They provide services to their people. They promote an Islamist form of government and society. But they can't do all these things all the time. So now that they're moving into national government, they're probably going to focus on governance more than the other things.
Rami Khoury, once again, the editor at large of the Daily Star in Beirut. To stay with us, if you will, I'll come back to you in a moment. I want to first introduce Raphael Frankel. He's a reporter for the Jerusalem Post, covers the Palestinian territories, also covers politics in Israel itself. He was in Gaza for the election. Raphael Frankel, welcome to you.
Hi, good morning.
Wanted to ask you, in the context of what we just heard from Rami Khoury, who says that Hamas now has more legitimacy because of its democratic victory than any other government in the Arab world, do Israelis look at it that way?
Yeah, the Israeli people definitely look at the Hamas victory as legitimate. It was free and fair by any standard that anyone seems to have measured. The Israeli people are waking up and realizing that, look, we have a democracy, and now so do they. Whether they wanted Hamas is a different story, but that's what they have, and they are accepting it. The government is something else. If the government so far has been saying that they're not going to deal with the Palestinian Authority if Hamas is leading the government, now that obviously remains to be seen. They were saying that before the elections, and they're saying it still afterwards, but eventually, it seems like they're going to have to talk. You know, Ravi just said they coordinate all the time on basic day-to-day issues. So there's going to have to be some kind of arrangement, and that might take shape of, you know, if Hamas has, for instance, Mr. Barghouti, who you had on the program just a minute ago, join the government and his party, or other parties, for instance, that are led by Salam Fayyad, the former finance minister, if they can join a coalition and be appointed to high-level ministries, then perhaps there's a way to get around it all whereby Israel coordinates their policies with those particular people or something along those lines.
Hasn't Israel said, though, that if Hamas plays any role in the government at all, it won't negotiate?
They've said that. I mean, but what can you do? I think, you know, they've been saying that all along, but, you know, a month from now, 2 months from now, after the Israeli elections are over, when the political rhetoric dies down, people are going to wake up and realize, hey, we're still stuck with each other out here. We have to, you know, some way we have to go forward. We have to at least talk. That doesn't mean they're going to come to some kind of grand peace deal, but to say that forever and ever until death do us part that we won't talk, it doesn't seem that that's realistic. But they may also try and pressure Hamas, for instance, to change its charter, which doesn't cause the destruction of Israel. Whether Hamas wants to do that, you know, that's anyone's guess.
Raphael Frankel again at the Jerusalem Post. Back to Rami Khoury with the Daily Star in Beirut. Once again, what about the position of the other Arab countries, the Islamic countries? Will they recognize the legitimacy of a Hamas-led government, as you defined it, and will they be able to provide more assistance then to the Palestinian territories than they have been before?
Oh, I don't think there's any question that the other Arab countries would recognize a Hamas-led government. They deal with Islamist groups all over the place. You've got Muslim Brotherhood winning big in Egypt in the recent elections. Hezbollah is in the government in Lebanon. The Americans just kindly installed the Shiite-led Islamist government for the people of Iraq. You have major Islamic groups all over the region, which other Arab countries deal with. And the lesson,
but recognition is something different from support, particularly financial support.
Well, they're not supporting the government. They're supporting the Palestinian people. And the level of Arab support, anyway, has been a little bit flat in recent years.
Okay.
It'll continue, of course, because they're supporting the Palestinian cause is a very popular cause in most of the Arab countries. And what happens is with the experience, we've seen this in Turkey and in other places, as Islamists get into government, incumbency sparks a significant amount of responsibility and moderation and realism. So once you're in government, you have to be much more realistic, and you're accountable to your citizens. You've got to deliver on the things that are important to people, otherwise you'll be thrown out.
Rami Khoury, once again, at the Daily Star in Beirut. This is To the Point from PRI. Back to Raphael Frankel, our reporter for the Jerusalem Post. You mentioned the election upcoming in Israel, the political rhetoric that seems to marginalize Hamas, even though, as both you and Rami Khoury say, there's a lot of dealing with Hamas that is going on now. Is there any sentiment for cutting off the water, cutting off the electricity, not dealing with the Palestinian territories in any way? And is that part of the political rhetoric at this point?
No, that's not really part of the political rhetoric. I mean, that's only been raised by the really, really extreme right wing. I mean, not even Likud, headed by Benjamin Netanyahu, has really brought that up. I think that we probably won't see that. But ahead of the Israeli elections, which are scheduled for March 28th, we are going to see a lot. We're going to have to see now from Ehud Olmert, the acting prime minister and the leader of the Kadima party. He's going to have to, at least in words, kind of move a little to the right so that he doesn't allow Benjamin Netanyahu and the Likud to gain back some of the seats that they seem to have lost in the polls since Kadima broke away. They're not really worried so much about the left wing and Amir Peretz because he's not really viewed as a viable leader at this point. But I think, like I said, it's political time here. It's election season in Israel also. So all of this kind of plays together. And once the dust settles, if Kadima still does win the elections like everyone is projecting, then I think after that we'll see things kind of start to settle down and some kind of talking will start to begin.
Rami Khoury, the Hamas leadership has said that it will continue to observe the ceasefire that began in February. Do you think that will continue and that particularly they won't want to do anything disruptive while the Israelis are in the midst of a political campaign?
I think that depends on the kind of analysis that Hamas does now in the next couple of weeks. They're becoming more pragmatic with time, and we've seen this over the last year. They understand that they now have responsibilities that they have to carry out to their own people, but they also understand their linkages potentially to Israel and to the rest of the world. So they're going to be analyzing this very seriously and looking at what is it that they can do that can enhance their stature and their credibility around the world, because they've got a big problem globally with the U.S. and the Europeans and others who won't deal with them. And they've got to figure out what to do. What they're going to do, I think, is the same thing that the PLO did in the last 20 years, because the PLO was in the same situation 25 years ago. They refused to talk to Israel. Israel refused to talk to them. It was a crime for any Israeli to have a contact with the PLO. It was a criminal offense. But eventually, of course, the PLO and Israel talked to each other, negotiated, signed agreements. And Hamas will go through the same process, but it will be based on reciprocity and simultaneity and mutuality.
Rami Khoury, we're out of time. I'm sorry to interrupt you. Editor-at-large of the Daily Star in Beirut, thanks so much for being with us. Thanks to Raphael Frankel at the Jerusalem Post and Mustafa Barghouti, recently elected to the parliament in the Palestinian territories. We'll be right back with To the Point.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warman Alney back with To the Point, to talking today in the aftermath of the extraordinary victory by Hamas in the parliamentary elections in the Palestinian territories, hearing that things are much more complicated, perhaps, than they appeared at first, from Mustafa Barghouti, himself elected to parliament, although in opposition to both Hamas and Fatah. And from our other guests, we heard that there may be a lot more flexibility on the part of both Hamas and the Israelis, for that matter, particularly after the Israeli election takes place. The question becomes, of course, what about the European Union? What about the United States? We'll talk first about the United States. Cliff May is president of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, created in the wake of the attacks on September 11th, very supportive of President Bush in the war on terror. Cliff May was communications director at one point for the Republican National Committee. Cliff May, good to have you back on our program.
Thank you. Good to be with you, Warren.
What do you say to what we just heard, that it may well be that, first of all, there is a negotiation, there are contacts between Hamas and Israel all the time, apparently, because of the Palestinian territory's dependence on Israel in such important ways. Secondly, that Hamas itself may be much more flexible, much more practical, much more pragmatic than we've led to believe. If those things are true, what about the United States, and what stand should we take?
Well, first, I would say that President Bush has been very clear that he's not going to have contacts with an organization that is listed as a terrorist organization. That doesn't mean others can't, but he will not. And I don't think he'll provide money to Hamas. He made through to other NGOs and other groups within the West Bank and Gaza. I think there's a distinction that needs to be made that hasn't. Having contacts is not the same as negotiating. Contacts is over how Israel is going to supply electricity and water, negotiations over whether or not this conflict can be settled. I think you'll have contacts. They may or may not lead to negotiations, which gets to your other point. Hamas has it in their charter, but also as a matter of religious doctrine, that there cannot be an Israel, there cannot be a Jewish state, that all of Palestine, all of the Middle East and beyond is a Muslim entitlement. Wafq, I think, is the word for that. And it'll be very hard for Hamas to change that deeply held religious view.
We've heard, though, from Mustafa Barghouti, from Rami Khoury, and yesterday on our program from Khalil Shikaki, who's the pollster in the Palestinian territories, that the vote really wasn't as much for Hamas as it was a protest against Fatah. What about the possibility that Hamas itself may be much more diverse than the charter itself suggests, and that there are ways to deal with other people in Hamas, other leaders, who might not be so committed or so religiously devout?
Well, look, I think it's I think if that's true, the onus is on Hamas to show it. And to go back to the old idea of, well, there are moderate elements that we need to assist and to whom we should make concessions because that'll make everything all right, that is a theory that's been tested many times, not least with Arafat and Fatah and the PLO, also in terms of Iran, and it has always failed. It is true, I'm sure, that in part this vote was a protest against Fatah, which has been hopelessly corrupt and which, by the way, also has supported and encouraged and legitimized terrorism against the Israelis. But I think that what you might be able to see as a matter of pragmatic policy is Hamas saying a truce is best for us at this point. For example, an attack on Israel at this point would only help Netanyahu. It would not help Kadima and Ehud Olmert. Depending on their analysis, and I think Hamas analysis is difficult to divine, they might think we don't want to help Netanyahu at this point. It's also true, and I think very consequential, that once Hamas is in control, an attack from Palestinian territory is different than it used to be. Arafat could say in the morning that he denounced the act of terrorism and then celebrate it in the afternoon, and everyone went along with that fiction. With Hamas, that'll be more difficult. An attack is likely, again, depending on who the Israeli leadership is, to bring a very severe reprisal, not just against a particular group, but against Hamas, which will be seen as responsible.
What about the Al-Aqsa Murders Brigade and the other groups that are not apparently willing even to talk to Hamas about moderating their activities? Would the Israelis, do you think, then, in effect, hold Hamas responsible for their actions?
I think it very well might. It might say, look, any terrorism against us that comes from territory that you control will be your responsibility. We will hold you accountable and responsible. Imagine if we were being attacked from Mexican territory. Would we not hold the Mexican government responsible?
Okay.
I think we would, and I think the Israelis may as well.
Cliff May, president for the Foundation of Democracies, listening closely to our conversation so far is Alastair Crook. He is former security advisor to Javier Solana, foreign policy head of the European Union, has been involved in negotiations with the Palestinians, with Hamas and other groups there for a long, long time. He's founder of Conflict Forum, which is an organization devoted to negotiating peace. And Alastair Crook, we're glad to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. Good evening.
What do you say to what Cliff May has said, that the Hamas charter is what it is, that the onus is on Hamas to change its ways very specifically and by its actions as well before the U.S. or Israel enters into any kind of negotiation?
Yes, I think I clearly hear the message is that the onus is all on Hamas, but I think there's another concept in which actually this is very much a test for the West, too. We called for elections. They were at the insistence of the quartet. We've had elections. Hamas won them. And I think everyone accepts that they were won without coercion and quite freely chosen as the leadership. I think, therefore, it's a bigger issue, an issue that extends beyond Palestine, that if the West responds only in terms of hostility and negativity to this election, it will have the risk of souring or indeed coloring Europe and the United States' relationship with Muslims much more widely than within Palestine. The Palestinian elections have had a big impact throughout the region. I mean, an earthquake. And I think that if we simply say, well, we don't talk, we don't deal, it will seem quite perverse to many Muslims that we can call for elections, get elections, have free elections, more free than anywhere else, and then simply try to ignore or deny those elections. So I think it's very important that at the same time that we may express our own policy, but we do need to make sure that there is that we react positively and that we also try and help the transition, because transitions are always difficult. They never happen overnight, and they do take time to emerge properly. And we need to adjust to that and recognize that.
You said more free elections than anywhere else. Earlier, Rami Khoury of the Daily Star in Beirut said that these elections are more make the Hamas government of the Palestinian territories more legitimate than any other government in the Arab world. Is that a fair statement?
I think that's absolutely right. I think what Rami Khoury said was absolutely correct. Many people are looking to Hamas for leadership. I notice many people have described the election result as simply a vote against Fatah. I mean, clearly there was an element of great alienation and disaffection with Fatah throughout the Palestinian territories. But at the same time, it wasn't just simply a protest vote. The Hamas was voted for many other reasons, because people believe in their approach, particularly in their community support, and on their ethos and on their line, their political line as well. So I think it's too easy just to simply ignore it or describe it as a protest vote against Fatah. We have to recognize that Fatah is in great difficulties. It seems to have lost its direction in many ways, deeply divided, and indeed has been almost at the point of crumbling into sort of small personal fiefdoms rather than representing a movement.
If Hamas is, in fact, as practical, as pragmatic as has been described, do you think there's any chance that the leaders now will, in order to improve their standing with Israel and the rest of the world, and by that I mean the Western world, change its charter and perhaps renounce violence as well?
I think you will see. There will be a speech tomorrow, I believe, by Khaled Meshal. And I think it will set out a vision for the future. Hamas certainly intends, and they were very explicit when we met with them just last month, about their desire to have an inclusive government. They do not want to see one faction simply replaced by the dominance of another faction, and they will go to great efforts to try and draw in other groups and other movements into the government, and to try and agree national objectives and national tools to meet those objectives with as wide a population as is possible, with a wider political grouping as it is possible. I think they have actually already made gestures. They may not have been widely noted, but they did very clearly say during the election they dropped from their platform the call for the destruction of Israel. And it was said clearly by the number two on the national list that this was not a tactical decision, but did represent a strategic decision mm-hmm. on their part. I think they feel that equally there has not been much response from the West in the sense of understanding Palestinian feelings towards what happened in 48 and that what occurred to them in terms of destruction of their villages and removal into refugee camps is not perceived as being fair or just for Palestinians. So I think there is a way, in fact, of squaring that circle in finding the right language that both recognizes the reality that exists today, but at the same time expresses some understanding for the Palestinian narrative of what happened to them in 48.
All right. We're talking with Alastair Crook, the founder of the Conflicts Forum and former advisor to Javier Solana of the European Union. I want to go back to Cliff May at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy, particularly on this question of legitimacy. President Bush says one arm of his foreign policy is to spread democracy around the world. He said himself yesterday that this suggests the spread of liberty in the Middle East. Does it not behoove him then, particularly given the view of the other Islamic countries, which you've heard about from Alastair Crook, to take a more flexible stand with regard to Hamas?
Respecting the choices that the Palestinians make implies that the Palestinians will take the consequences of those choices. One of the banners that Hamas had for this election was that Israel and the United States favor Fatah, so who would you want to vote for? That was, in other words, an expression of hostility on the part of Hamas to the United States as well as to Israel. We need to respect their choices. We don't need to approve of their choices. If the Palestinians decide that they want an all-out war with Israel to the death, that is their right to do. But they must take the consequences. I think one of the things that about democracy that is useful over time is that citizens become accustomed to assuming the consequences for what that which they have authority, they take responsibility. And that is part of this exercise this time. Also, let's be clear, this was a free and fair election as far as it goes. But nobody can kid themselves that some of that Palestinians could have organized, say, a peace party, that somebody could have gotten up on a soapbox in Ramallah and said, let's settle this once and for all with the Israelis so we have a better future tomorrow. Such a candidate would have been killed.
Well, we had Mustafa Barghouti on a moment ago, who, in fact, won a seat to the legislature, who said he thinks most Palestinians want to see peace with Israel.
He said that, but there is no party saying, I will give you that. I will give you that in the first 100 days. And it couldn't happen. You don't have civil society. One of the problems and misunderstandings about democratization is that all you need is to have elections and it's done. We haven't had a real free press in this area. We don't have a development of civil society. We haven't had any of that under Fatah, under Arafat over the past 10 years. We've had assassinations and we've had bullying and we've had corruption. So without civil society, elections, again, these are the freest and fair elections we've probably had in much of the Middle East in a long time. I agree with that. Hamas won. People voted. But again, let's understand this is not the Western idea of elections. But again,
okay. Let me go back. We're running short of time, and I apologize for that, Cliff May, at the Defense of Democracies. But Alastair Crook, back to you with the Conflicts Forum. Interested in your comment on that, on the idea that people have to be accountable for their vote. Quickly, if you will, a response to that, and then tell us
who
briefly.
Who decides that they need to be accountable for their vote? Is this the United States? It seems a very strange way of respecting a democratic choice is to try and concert a program of isolation and marginalization of those who've been freely elected in an election. I mean, and by what criteria do we decide that they've made a mistake and must pay the consequences for their electoral choices?
I don't believe many people would assume the right to do that for the United States,
okay,
even if they disagreed with the outcome.
Let me interrupt you, if I may, because I want to ask a final question, and it has to do with dealing with the Hamas government. It's my understanding that in the United States there are laws that might make it difficult for the president to do that because of the charter of Hamas. Is the European Union also conflicted in the way that the United States is about this?
It is to a certain extent. Some member states do have legal impediment to dealing with Hamas, and it's not quite clear how this will be resolved. But I think ultimately it will be. I think there'll be a hiatus when it'll be a little confused and there'll be different sounds coming out of Europe from different member states. But it's very difficult to see Europe walking away from the Palestinian people, particularly in the case in Gaza, where over 70% of the families there are living on less than $2 a day family income. It just seems unlikely that Europe will walk away with it, walk away from it completely. I'm sure they'll find some workaround that will allow people to continue to survive in very difficult circumstances in Gaza.
Well, thank you both for being with us. Alistair
thank
Crook,
you.
Formerly with the European Union, now with the Conflicts Forum, and Cliff May, president of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies in Washington. Look forward to talking to you both on future programs. This is To the Point from PRI. The Senate Judiciary Committee approved Judge Samuel Alito's nomination to the U.S. Supreme Court on strictly party lines. 10 Republicans yes, 8 Democrats no. And with Republicans in the majority, conventional wisdom has been that final confirmation was guaranteed by the full Senate. Now, several Democrats have called for a filibuster, even though they admit they're likely to fail. More on that in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
And I'll be back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. The U.S. Senate is scheduled to vote on Judge Samuel Alito on Tuesday, just hours before President Bush delivers his State of the Union address. Now, Democrats Kerry and Kennedy of Massachusetts and Durbin of Illinois are among those talking filibuster. John Harwood's national political editor for The Wall Street Journal. And, John, always good to have you with us.
Hey, Warren.
Other Democrats don't seem to feel this way. There's quite a lot of division there. Is there any likelihood that a filibuster might succeed?
None. I think this is more about constituency politics of a couple of different kinds. Ted Kennedy, who is sort of the ideological leader of his party in the Senate, I think is trying to make a point with liberal interest groups, feminists, African-American groups, civil rights groups, that Democrats are willing to stand up and fight against a nominee who they all profoundly disagree with. In the case of John Kerry, his partner from Massachusetts, Kerry wants to run for president again in 2008, as he did in 2004. And by signaling to activists that I'm willing to fight this to the hilt, that's one way of him getting some traction or attention, at least, in a race where most people think he's got a fairly slim chance.
Started the fight from a distance, though. He's in Switzerland at the Davos conference and apparently talking to everybody on a cell phone. Is that really going to be persuasive, do you think, to the core of Democratic voters that want to see him be willing to take a fight?
No, I think I tell you, Warren, that was sort of unfortunate symbolism on Kerry's part. It's not too dissimilar from the in a symbolic way from the windsurfing that he did in the summer of 2004, which made people think he was a little bit out of touch. The idea that you're mounting your filibuster from Switzerland and then flying back for it isn't exactly the imagery that you want. The problem is that, first of all, Republicans appear to be holding all 55 of their members. We don't know that for 100% certainty, but it looks that way. And then you've got...
Even Lincoln Chafee in Rhode Island?
It appears that way. Lincoln Chafee's got a conservative challenger in the Republican primary, and he's got to be concerned about his right flank as well as the state being a fairly liberal state, generally speaking. So the White House is confident they're going to hold Chafee, they're going to hold Olympia Snow of Maine, and they've already held Susan Collins of Maine. So if they can keep all 55, they only need five Democrats to achieve the 60-vote threshold, which obviates a filibuster and, of course, is 10 more than you need to confirm. They've got four announced so far, and Kent Conrad said favorable things about Alito today. So this looks doomed. And what you've got, Warren, is some moderate Democratic senators who in many cases are willing to vote against Alito, but they're not willing to look like they're obstructing a nominee who's got majority support. And so even if they should end up voting against Alito, this is people like Mary Landrieu of Louisiana, Dianne Feinstein of California, even if they end up voting against Alito, they don't want to participate in a filibuster, and that's why there's no chance.
Aren't there also some Democrats running in red states who have problems with this and the kind of obstructionism that might be used against them in their campaigns? Have Senators Kerry and Kennedy and the others put them in sort of a difficult position?
Exactly so, and that's why they're not going to succeed. You look at the ones who have announced that they're supporting Alito so far. Tim Johnson of South Dakota, Ben Nelson of Nebraska. These are states the president carried comfortably. Democrats expect they're going to lose both Byron Dorgan and Kent Conrad of North Dakota. Robert Byrd of West Virginia, who's served in the Senate for quite a long time. That's a state that has gone to George W. Bush in the last couple of presidential races. He's trying to prevent any sort of credible challenge from developing. He might have voted for Alito in any case, but he is going to vote for him this time.
Talk to John Harwood, national political editor for the Wall Street Journal. What about Hillary Clinton?
Well, Hillary Clinton, of course, is against Samuel Alito, announced that earlier this week. She's got a fine line to walk, one to continue to remind liberals that she's on their side. Now, one would think that message had been pretty well driven home by her record up to now. She's also trying to show that she's a mainstream politician, and on issues like Iraq and national security, she's taken a tough line that is properly interpreted, I think, as an effort to reach out to the middle. Conducting a filibuster against a judge who's got majority support might be a risky move for somebody in that situation. So I think that's a very fascinating question as to whether she attempts to make this work. But it's all going to be mooted on Monday because the votes simply aren't there for Democrats to keep talking on this.
The Republicans act as if they wish there were the votes there, that at least they could kick the Democrats around a little bit on this.
I think the White House would view that as a tremendous opportunity. If they somehow delayed Judge Alito beyond the State of the Union speech, and the president, before a national TV audience, could flay the Democrats for being unreasonably obstructionist, I think that would be a gift to the White House, but it's one that the Democrats are not likely in the end to give him.
What issues do those Democrats who are not in favor of this filibuster feel would work better for Democrats in this election year?
The number one issue for Democrats in this election year is Iraq, because that is what's clouding the public attitude toward this administration and this White House. Secondly, you've got a lot of anxiety out there about the financial straits that major iconic American businesses are in. We're talking about the airline companies, Ford and GM. Millions of workers believing that their health care benefits and their pensions are at risk. Those are powerful issues that Democrats can use. And you also have the issue of corruption. Now that the Abramoff scandal has flowered, we saw the president on the defensive at a press conference yesterday, declining to release information about meetings and photographs of himself with Jack Abramoff. All these are things that work against the party in power, and the one sort of downside that comes when you have both the White House and the Congress is that you are the accountable party, and we know that Americans, having gotten used to divided government for a long time, with a president of one party, Congress of another, they know the Republicans are in charge, and Democrats are banking on that sort of broad discontent to bring them a victory this fall.
You mentioned Iraq as the number one issue that people are concerned about. Earlier in our program, we talked with Frank Newport, the editor-in-chief of the Gallup poll, and he had an interesting comment on that. He said that although 58% of the people they have polled recently say that they think the president's second term is a failure, he said the big thing they're concerned about is the economy. Although I think he lumped in some of the things you included, health care in particular, as part of that. But what's the president expected to do on the State of the Union, in the State of the Union, to respond to the issues where it appears he's the weakest?
Well, I think his options are not terrific on that point. You do have the paradox of an economy that has strong overall indicators. The economy's growing at a substantial pace, has been for a couple of years. Productivity is growing, but the average worker's wages are not keeping pace with those increases, and so it raises the specter of an economy where corporations are doing very well and people at the top are doing well, but ordinary workers are not. That's an asset for the president. Now, part of that anxiety has had to do with the spike in energy prices that we saw last year, and that's moderated somewhat. So to the extent that gas prices are no longer, you know, over $3 a gallon as they were for a while, people may find a little more solace in terms of their assessments of the economy. But you cannot underestimate the effect of health care costs and worries about people's pensions. We had a year-long debate on Social Security last year in which the president went around the country, said the system's going broke, we got to do something about it. Well, guess what? Nothing was done about it, and people know that. So there's a lot of unease.
What about health care costs and the emphasis, as I understand, he's going to give to the health savings accounts? When they are described now in the mainstream press, that effort is often summarized as shifting costs to patients. Is that going to be good for the president?
Well, you just identified the real contradiction in their message, or the pitfall of their message. They believe, and some healthcare experts believe, that if healthcare consumers had more of what the White House advisors call skin in the game, meaning if it wasn't just a third-party payer, an insurance company paying when you go to the doctor, but you're paying some, people would become more discriminating consumers of healthcare. As a political message, the idea we're going to fix the system by making you pay more, that's not such a great message, and that's one of the reasons why Democrats feel that health care remains, even though the president's going to talk about some of these health care tax credits and some of these transparency measures to get people aware, make them more price sensitive. Democrats think this is an issue they can make a lot of gains on.
Okay. Well, we started with the filibuster, and Judge Alito have gone a long way, and thanks a lot for being with us. John Harwood.
My pleasure.
National political editor for the Wall Street Journal. The producers of To the Point are Francis Anderton, Katie Cooper, Jonah King, Christian Bordahl, and Sherman Rimbaum. Our managing producers, Karen Radziner. Special thanks to Greg Goodfellow. Thanks also to the John Coltrane family. You hear his music behind us. Our technical director is Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.